Then we move to the third case this morning, Barr v. Gonzalez. Mr. Burt.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Justin Burton. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Daniel Lara in a petition for review of the Board of Immigration Appeals' decision. At issue in this case is whether the immigration judge violated Mr. Lara's right to due process by preventing him to present his own case in chief. Mr. Lara has been in the United States since 1978. Except for a three-year period from 1981 to 1983, he has lived here continuously since his childhood. He sought before the immigration court a form of relief called cancellation of removal. In order to be eligible for cancellation removal, he must demonstrate that he's a person of good moral character, has not committed an aggravated felony, has a qualifying relationship and where he has two United States citizen children, and has 10 years of physical presence prior to the service of the notice to appear or the charging document to put him before the immigration court. The issue in this case, when looked at the evidence, was what happened in the period of 1992 when income wasn't shown on the Social Security statements. The immigration judge bifurcated the hearing to determine whether he had actually broke the continuous physical presence in the United States for the 10 years prior to the service of the notice to appear. If he had left the United States more than 90 days at any one given vacation or leave, he would have broke the continuous presence requirement. If he had left the United States in the aggregate period of time during the 10-year period of 180 days or more, he would have been found to have broke the continuous residence. So the merits hearing, or the bifurcated hearing, was set up solely to determine whether, in fact, he had this 10 years of continuous presence. Due process requires a meaningful opportunity to be heard before the immigration court and to present your case. In this case, Mr. Lara had presented evidence to establish his 10-year period of time and presence in the United States. When entering into the courtroom, the immigration judge immediately began asking questions about this 10-year continuous presence requirement. Mr. Lara's counsel did not ask even one question throughout the entire merits hearing. There was one question asked, and that was to ask the question again that the immigration judge had posed to Mr. Lara. We must also keep in mind that the immigration judge has some latitude to question the petitioner, an alien, in a hearing. He also is a fact finder, as well as he is obligated to establish a record in the case. However, in this case, where he was presented by counsel, and the counsel, who is an immigration practitioner and has been such for 30-some-odd years, certainly has the ability to be able to question the alien. In this case, he wasn't provided that opportunity. Instead,
is this questioning, was there a translator involved in any question?
Yes, I believe there was a translator involved. Mr. Lara does speak fairly well, but I'm not quite certain if there was or was not, but I'm sure there probably was.
Did his wife testify as well?
His wife testified, but in a strange order. While Mr. Lara was answering the questions of the IJ, he was asked to be excused while the wife had been brought to the stand to ask when they were married. And it was in 1993, I think in December of 1993, she stated. And then once he was done asking the questions of Mrs. Lara, he excused her and had Mr. Lara retake the stand again. So instead of asking all the questions of Mr. Lara and then proceeding in a linear fashion, instead stopped Mr. Lara's testimony, called the wife, and then dismissed her, and then called Mr. Lara, again, without providing the petitioner's counsel an opportunity to ask questions at that time as well. In Padillo, the court noted that there are two different instances where an IJ can interrupt and ask questions, one in which to focus or direct the examination. For instance, if the petitioner's counsel had started bringing in irrelevant facts or facts not related to seeking that form of relief or deportability or whatnot. The second one is where the IJ asks questions and it cuts off the presentation of the case. We suggest that Mr. Lara's case falls into the second issue stated in Padilla, where the IJ began pretermitting some of the questions, and some of the questions that must have been asked before the court, which it never was asked. For instance, in the 1992 period of time, there should have been asked questions as to, he was working side jobs at that time, but detailed questions, as is, who was the employer at that time? Where did you work? How many days a week did you work? Did you earn income? Did you collect a W-2 statement? None of these questions were asked. In fact, at the end of the presentation, or not the presentation, but the inquiry by the immigration judge, he turned towards district counsel, assistant district counsel, and said, I don't even have to have you ask questions on cross-examination, because looking at the facts that I've solicited, in light of most favorable to the alien, he did not demonstrate that he had the 10 years of continuous presence. Yes, he used these buzzwords, but he didn't provide an opportunity for counsel to solicit the facts of the case.
Was there any evidence that counsel tried to ask these questions?
There was in clarification in one of the IJ's questions. But other than that, the hearing from the reading of the transcript moved so quickly where he had witnesses jumping or coming off the stand and then bringing another witness on and then bringing another witness off and then on again, and then began even just questioning the witnesses without even providing an opportunity of counsel to present or even lay a foundation. I think the problem existed here in just simply laying a foundation and taking him through a chronological fashion.
How did the wife, I gather that the counsel for Mr. Lara didn't call the wife in the midst of Mr. Lara's testimony, did he?
He did not, Your Honor. It was the IJ's decision to have the wife come in and testify in the middle of Mr. Lara's testimony.
Is Judge Vinicor?
Yes, Your Honor, it is Judge Vinicor. In Ms. Gaudet's case, Ms. Gaudet had her case decided a couple months ago before this court. In this case, Judge Rovner was concerned about a de facto cross-examination that was being done by the immigration judges. We feel in this case that's precisely what was happening. Even though the transcripts don't necessarily or may not necessarily show a very aggressive approach to questioning, the bottom line is we have to look at we have to look at the questioning through the eyes of the alien. And an alien who is uneducated and comes before the court trying to explain what's going on with his life and what's happened in the past, sometimes even very innocuous questions can appear to the alien as very aggressive. And it may appear to him as cross-examination. He may become hesitant in answering these questions or confused. And even an instance in the record,
If that's confusion. Right, then the judge couldn't ask any questions.
Well, again, we have to relate back to Padilla, where a judge can ask questions to focus the examination or to solicit very simple facts. Where there's counsel involved, and counsel is not provided any opportunity whatsoever to question his own client.
You concede that the questioning wasn't hostile.
I don't think I conceded it. I think just the reading of it doesn't show an over-aggressive approach, but we have to look at it from the alien's eyes, through the alien's eyes, where it may be aggressive towards the alien, and where the alien's own counsel isn't provided an opportunity to just solicit facts.
What happened, for example, when the testimony of Mr. Lara was concluded? Did the immigration judge ask his counsel if he had any questions that he wanted to ask?
There's no question in the record to present or to counsel whether he had questions for his own client.
Inviting cross-examination?
At one point, he looked at assistant district counsel and said, I'm not going to invite you to do cross-examination because I've already found that he's not credible before my court. He basically said there was no reason for him to cross-examination because he already is going to make a finding that the 10-year physical presence requirement has not been met. I'll reserve, if there are any other questions, I'd like to reserve in order to respond.
That's fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Burke? Or Mr. Flynn, sorry.
Thanks, sir. May it please the court, my name is Steve Flynn. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, the Attorney General. Just as a preliminary matter, I'd like to start off. The hearing was conducted without an interpreter. on January 9th, 2003. This is a page 68 and 69 of the administrative record. Petitioner's counsel informed the judge there was no need for an interpreter because petitioner spoke English. He speaks English fluently.
How about the wife?
The wife, they did use an interpreter for her.
So there was an interpreter involved?
Yes, sir.
That was my question.
Okay, sir. As a preliminary matter, due process is not implicated in this case. The court has recognized that a petitioner has no liberty or property interest in obtaining purely discretionary relief, and denial of such relief, therefore, cannot implicate due process. This court has recognized that in a number of cases. Dave v. Ashcroft, Ali v. Ashcroft, and Hamden v. Ashcroft. All three of those cases stress and reaffirm that cancellation of removal is a form of discretionary relief, and therefore due process can't be implicated in such a situation. Nevertheless, the constitutional claim is baseless. There are four prerequisites, four criteria for cancellation of removal, and they're written in the conjunctive, so the failure to meet any one of the four is fatal to the application. Questions regarding petitioner's physical presence were first raised on January 9th, 2003. At the hearing, the immigration judge specifically identified that as an area of concern, and after that granted petitioner two continuances totaling 11 months to marshal his evidence on physical presence. In fact, the merits hearing wasn't held until approximately 1 year later on January 6, 2004. So petitioner had almost or virtually 1 year to gather all his evidence on physical presence. Now, as far as the evidence that he actually did present, obviously there were some questions that were raised based on his documentary material. And the reason the immigration judge did get involved in questioning the petitioner was at the hearing in January 2004, petitioner's counsel showed up and said, here's a tax return for 1992, and that should allay the court's concerns as to his physical presence. The immigration judge looked at the form and saw that it was filed in 1992, but it was for the year 1991. At that point, he turned to the petitioner and said, well, were you working there or not? Because it was almost as though it was a process of discovery for petitioner's own counsel. He showed up saying, here's a tax return for 1992, and that should show that he's been working, and it was promptly discovered that that wasn't the case. It's important to realize here that while petitioner's counsel may not have been doing, while the immigration judge was doing the bulk of the question, no objection was ever made at any time by petitioner's counsel, and nor has he made any proffer as to what he would have presented differently if he'd been able to present his quote-unquote case in chief. There's nothing to show that the IJ immigration judge's comportment or conduct was contrary to statute or regulation. Statute provides at 8 U.S.C. 1229 AB1, the immigration judge has statutory responsibility of administering oaths, receiving evidence, interrogating, examining, and cross-examining the alien and any witnesses. And as petitioner conceded, but then, I mean, it's not really set forth, doesn't allege in any way, shape, or form that the immigration judge was unfair or impartial in his questioning. Turning to the actual evidence that was presented, obviously there was a huge area of concern regarding 1992.
Let me ask you this. In yes, these sir. Proceedings, is it, do they normally go according to what we consider in federal court, the presentation of evidence by the petitioner, and then a cross-examination by district counsel, and then any questions the judge may have, or the judge just takes it over? Is that the way it's done?
No, sir. I mean, it's the first example. It's usually fairly straightforward. The petitioner presents his case, there's cross-examination, and then the immigration judge can interpose questions. But as I mentioned, the only reason the immigration judge did step forward in this case was, importantly, petitioner's own counsel didn't have the facts of his claim straight. And also, it's critical to remember that all evidence pertaining to the issue of physical presence was presented. Unlike the circumstances in Podio or Rodriguez Galicia or Kersicu, there was no evidence that petitioner was unable to present. He may not have liked what that evidence showed, but he was not precluded or prevented from presenting any evidence. And once again, there was never any objection to the manner in which the proceedings were conducted, nor, once again, any proffer by petitioner that if given the opportunity, he would have done something, this is how he would have presented it. And once again, as far as the actual findings made by the immigration judge, there's a glaring inconsistency or irregularity as far as his earnings here in the United States. The Social Security statement from 1988 to 2002 shows that he earned money every year in the United States except for one, 1992, where he declares zero earnings. Now, this is contrasted with his income from all the other years, wherein he earned upwards to $59,000. So, obviously, that's a glaring irregularity that needed to be explained. And petitioner's testimony was certainly not consistent or coherent on that point.
What year did he get married in Mexico? Was it 92 or 93?
It was 93. He originally said it was in 1992, and that's why his testimony was somewhat across the board. Also, they didn't submit the marital certificate. So that was, according to petitioner, at first he said it was 1992, and he had to take a leave of work. And there's some confusion as to which company he's working for. But then he subsequently came back and said, no, it was in 1993. Now, this is all wrapped up, all tied in with where he was working. Because he said that he was working for Eagle Concrete in 1991, and then went to work for Vertex Concrete in 1992, had to take a leave to go down to Mexico and get married in December 1992, and returned in January 1993. But this even conflicted with his own cancellation application that was prepared with his attorney. But then he promptly turned around.
What were the conflicts there?
Well, okay, so he said he was working for Eagle Concrete from 91 and then went to Vertex in 92 and took a leave. Actually, that was consistent with his cancellation application. But then he promptly testified that he was actually married in December 93 and that he was working for Vertex Concrete in 93 and that he had to take a leave of absence from that company as opposed to Eagle Concrete, which he testified to previously. But then he said he was only out of work. He worked for Eagle. So based on this second version, he was working at Eagle Concrete until December 92 and then went to work for Vertex in May 93. So then the immigration judge asked him, well, how come your Social Security statement shows no earnings from 1992? At that point, petitioner and his attorney consulted the Social Security statement and discussed it amongst themselves. And then petitioner came back and said, well, I was mistaken. I actually stopped working at Eagle Concrete in November 1991. And not December 1992, and I was just confused. During that entire period, I was doing side jobs.
It's not within this 10-year period, but he was here since 78. Did he have Social Security records showing that he got income subject to Social Security between 78 and...
Well, he was only in 78, I believe he was 8 years old. So he was
okay.
So he was pretty young at that point. But
how about when he was 18? Well, 88.
Yeah, he showed earnings every year from 1988 to 2002, except for 1992. I mean, that was if you look at the record. I mean, it's in 1988 he made $3,000. 1991 he made $19,000. 93 $22,000. 1992 zero. That's at page page 159 of the administrative record.
It doesn't have much to do with it, but is the the requirement of 10 years continuous presence relatively new? Wasn't it a shorter period at one time?
For suspension of deportation, the predecessor to cancellation of removal, the requirement was 7 years continuous presence. And then with cancellation of removal, they made it 10 years continuous presence.
That was when, 96?
That was in 96, yes, sir. Any further questions, gentlemen?
I believe so. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, sir.
You have 1 minute to
Counsel indicates that Mr. Lara may not have jurisdiction to bring a due process claim before this court. We would submit they do. Each case cited by counsel were final decisions on cancellations of removal applications, and that is a discretionary form of relief, and therefore this court does not have jurisdiction. But in this case, it's a Morales type of case where it wasn't a discretionary decision, is rather based on whether, in fact, he had the 10 years of continuous residence in the United States. Also, there seems to be a glaring red herring in this case. The fact remains he was not provided an opportunity to present his case. It's not whether he had the one-year period absence in his Social Security statement. It's whether he was provided an opportunity to present his case in chief, to proceed in a chronological order, rather than an IJ stepping in and asking questions about an employment in 92, then a marriage in 93, and then going back to an 88 or an 89 question. It made it very difficult for Mr. Lara to follow, and he wasn't able to provide his own case in chief to proceed chronologically. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Again, thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.